Hello and welcome to another episode of The Grey NATO. It's a loose discussion of travel, adventure, diving, driving gear, and most certainly watches. And this is episode 369. It's proudly brought to you by the always growing TGN supporter crew. We thank you all so much for your continued support. And if you'd like to support the show, please visit thegreynato.com for more details. My name is James Stacey, and I'm joined as ever by my friend and co-host, Jason Heaton. Jason, how are we doing today?
I'm a little tired of winter, if I'm honest. We just got slammed yesterday, and today it was bitterly cold on the dog walk. It doesn't feel like March 16th, but the promise is that it's going to be back in the 50s and 60s later this week. So, you know, it's all going to be gone shortly and very muddy and wet. But for now it's pretty, but I'm just kind of tired of it.
Yeah, we got a dumping of snow on Friday, so it's all over the map for the next little while.
And you're headed to Switzerland here today, right?
Yeah, heading into Geneva for a quick photo shoot. So there for a day total, but you end up with two nights because of when you can and kind of can't travel back to the West. That should be a good one. It's for a great watch, possibly more than one, but not something I can talk about just yet. You'd have to give me another month or so. So this gives us a little bit of a head start on a cool story, which I'm excited for. Beyond that, just a busy weekend here. Obviously want to reiterate our reminder for the Vancouver and Montreal Timepiece Show tickets. You can get them at timepieceshow.com. I'm going to be at the Vancouver show. We're sorting out details for a Saturday night event with Marathon and Roldorf. So stay tuned for that. But the Vancouver show is at the end of April. The Montreal show is at the end of May. Both should be excellent occasions, and I'm certainly pumped for Vancouver. So be sure to check out those tickets if you're keen and in the area or want to make a trip in. I think it'll be a lot of fun.
Yeah, it's show season, isn't it? It's they just had the Dallas wind-up show. I saw a bunch on Instagram from there. And then you've got British Watchmaker's Day. Yeah, it's kicking off for sure.
Yeah, it sure is. But look, man, inquiring minds want/need to know. What's our cat update?
More of the same.
We have an official name.
She's running the show here already. Yeah, she does have a name. Mm-hmm. In fact, it got so official that we put her name on a little tag for a collar because, you know, in case she gets out, we want her to have a name and a phone number on a tag. And of course, we bought one of these collars that has like a, I don't know, I suppose it's made in case the cat gets hung up on something, it tears free. You know, like comes off, but she just flicks it off herself. So we're always finding it on the floor. So I think we need a different solution for the collar. But the name, now that it's engraved, it's become official, is Smitty.
Smitty, there you go.
Yeah, there's a bit of an inside joke to that name. For those who in Minneapolis who are familiar with a certain type of shop that's known as a Smitten Kitten, you can use your imagination what kind of shop that might be, or you can Google it. It's actually close by. We drive by it all the time. And we just drove by and saw the name and we looked at each other and thought, Smitty might be a good name. And it happens to also be kind of a derivation of some grandparents and great-grandparents of ours that had the name Smith that went by Smitty. So kind of a fun serendipity there. So yeah, it's fun. And, you know, I mean, with animals' names, oftentimes you end up with a lot of nicknames and things. So we just kind of shout whatever and the cat meows and comes, so the name is less important. But
yeah, it's funny because you mentioned that on the previous episode that, like, you know, cat names aren't as crucial as dog names.
Yeah,
like a cat may or may not know its name, and even if it does, it may or may not care that you've said anything, which is part of the delight of a cat. And then I've now seen that meme several times on Instagram of people like, these are my dog's names, and it's these like kind of official names, the kind of things you say to a dog.
Yeah,
and then the cat names are all these like just random messes of words. So I think you did well picking Smitty beyond some other options. So that's
there were a lot of suggestions on Slack, and I appreciate those. Some were like the Bond movie related. You know, we had Vesper. Mm-hmm. Well, you suggested Vesper, and a few people went with kind of watch related things. You know, we had Pogue,
sure,
which I thought Pogue would actually be a really fun one for a cat.
Great name.
Thanks for all the suggestions. But Smitty, it is, at least for the time being.
Fabulous. I love that.
Yeah.
Beyond my trip to Geneva this week. Next week, I'll be in New York, so that's the week of the 26th, and as I mentioned on the previous episode, we are starting a new series of sort of in-person, super casual, bring watches, hangout sort of vibe. We're calling them Hodinkee Happy Hours, and the first one is on the 26th. It's 4:30 to 6:30 at the Watches of Switzerland store in Soho. We're sorting out an awesome beer selection from Grotta in Soho, and we also have a solid pizza order coming in from a local shop that I'm pretty excited about. So if you happen to be in the area or can make it into New York, it'll be the last Thursday of every month, and this time it is the 26th. I'll be there. A couple of the others from the team will be there. Some folks from Analog Shift are going to pop down, hopefully to see Thomas Scalar. Got a text from him. Shout out, Thomas, if you're listening. I'm looking forward to it very much so, and just to be back in the city for a little while. So that should be good. But that pretty much, that's my next 2 weeks. I'm in Geneva for a few days, and then I'm home for a weekend. And then I'm off to New York for some some fun stuff, including that hangout.
Seems like that's been your cycle. You were in Geneva a while back, and you were also in New York a while back. So you're...
Yeah, it's definitely my Air Canada app is suggesting I'm on track to more status than I've ever had before. And I both feel and look more tired than I think I've ever looked before. so there's that. But yeah, it's been a busy season, and I feel like you could probably go back and catch like the last several years of talking about February, March, April. As me calling it a busy season, you can't really complain. This is barely a real job to begin with, but it's certainly busy. And as much as I'm looking forward to all the new watches and everything else that comes out in April, I'm also kind of equally looking forward to the sort of theoretically slower phases of May and June and that sort of thing. We're big summer heads on TGN, especially after kind of a long, wet, cold winter. So
yeah, definitely. Your mention of pizza, it's just like, it's only 9:30 on a Monday morning. And like, just your mention of pizza made me salivate. It's been a while. I'm kind of craving it. I'm not doing cheese these days, but there's some great places nearby here that do kind of a vegan pizzas and or just cheese-free or whatever. We often make our own here, and it's, I think I might have to dial something like that up later this week.
Yeah, I mean, hey, it's hard to go wrong with pizza. You know, I can't, as I'm sure many of you who have come to any event we've ever kind of thrown for TGN, I can't do the like white wine and crudités. I can't do the bottles of champagne. It has to be easier than that. And like, mm-hmm. I get it. Maybe pizza, we might have some greasy hands touching watches. But I think that's the worst of it.
Yeah.
And it turns out that in our circle of sort of watch nerds, between Hodinkee and Watches of Switzerland, we have an owner of a fantastic pizza spot, but it should be a really great hangout. And the only goal is for it to be as casual as possible. So show up, have a slice, have a beer, leave. It's early in the day.
Yeah.
Before dinner is the idea, like a true happy hour.
All right. Well, we've got another fun episode dialed up here. We're churning through the remnants of our 2025 Slack Q&A. And we've got a few to get to. I think we're down to probably the last two episodes
it'll be 10 parts.
Yeah, exactly. Right. So
chapter 9 of 10,
if we stay disciplined here and plow forward, we might get through half of the questions that are left and then pick up with another one in a few weeks to close it out. But let's do a wrist check before we dive into the questions.
Yeah. What have you got on this week?
I just put on this morning, actually, my Elliott Brown Holton GMT. I wore it a while back when we had Guy Allen on from Elliott Brown, which was a fun episode. And I don't know, it's a watch I find myself reaching for more and more these days. I've got it on this kind of light brown leather strap that it came on that sort of matches the kind of cafe au lait tinted lume on this watch. And it's just such a, it's a big heavy watch, but it's just so handsome. I just love wearing this thing. So that's what's on my wrist.
That's a goodie for sure.
Yeah. And how about you? You've got a classic, it looks like.
Yeah. I'm wearing my Explorer 2 this week. I've had it on, I wore it on Friday, and then I kind of kept it on for part of the weekend. And then I went and saw Crime 101, a movie, kind of an LA crime noir, very much in my zone, didn't really do it for me sort of movie. So I'm not going to recommend it. I don't think it's one that's going to hit film club anytime soon, but I wore the Aerospace to go see that because it's about sketchy thieves in LA and, you know, all that sort of thing. And I thought it kind of fit. And then the movie was just packed full of Rolex.
Oh,
so it's just been kind of on my mind. And then, you know, doing a little bit of time zone hopping, starting this evening with the trip out to Geneva, I thought this one kind of suits. And I don't know, it's one of those ones where it's like, it's easy to leave this in the watch box for even like months at a time.
Mm-hmm.
And then I put it on and it kind of makes everything else I have irrelevant. But yeah, I absolutely love this watch. I've got it on the Oyster bracelet and it's, you know, it's all set up and ready to jump time zones in a few hours. But yeah, hard to beat it as far as a you know, sort of travel watch goes that kind of links up with my style. And certainly it's a watch I've only been talking about for a decade. I got it for my 30th. So yeah.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Cool.
Yeah.
Good choice. All right.
Should be a good one. Couple of GMTs to kick off a week with some travel.
Yeah.
But look, let's jump into some Q&A. If this happens to be, man, I get this bad. This is bad every time I try and summarize what a Q&A is. But if this happens to be your first one, normally what we do for Q&As, which is a monthly episode. So if you're a supporter of the show, you can send in a recording from your voice memo app. We play it as a question, kind of feels like a call-in show. We do that once a month. Once a year, we open up a thread on the Slack and kind of flip it over. So it's just text questions. And, you know, I guess we must have gotten 70 or 80 if we're into 9 episodes of this. I don't really mind. It's a really fun way to kind of like actually answer questions people have rather than just dreaming up episodes. But that's basically the explanation of what a Q&A is. It's questions from the Slack, which is part of the supporter crew. But it's offered as an external episode. So if you like these questions and that sort of thing, and you're not part of the crew, you want to check it out. It's $5 a month. And if you go up to $100 a year, you can get a NATO and that sort of thing. So that's the pitch. And the first question comes from Sam Cordle.
Sam says, I'm suggesting a collecting advice watch draft challenge based on a personal collecting tension I've found as a professional with an office job, but who's also a big fan of the types of tool watches TGN tends to highlight. So Sam's challenge to us is a 5-watch collection for a young professional who loves outdoor adventure as the next TGNer, but finds that he has more occasion to wear dress or dressier sporty watches during the week. For the dressier watches, there's some interest in brand, cachet, but that's not the only consideration. The vision is versatility to maximize scenarios for each watch. Ideally, the collection would include at least one fancier watch, at least one everyday dressy sports watch, and at least one watch that can handle being beat up around the house or on adventures outside the office. Total collection composition is up to us. The budget is technically unlimited, but the guideline is that no single watch should be more than $12,000, and most watches should be under $6,000 and substantially less if possible. And then he says, once one of us picks a watch, the other cannot pick the same watch. So bit of a complicated challenge. I hope you stayed with us on that. You might have to rewind, you know, your 10 seconds at a time or whatever in your podcast app to listen to that over again to catch what the format is here. But James, you clear on this? You ready to go?
Yeah, I think it's we're picking 5 watches that we think blend a dressier version of a TGN sort of like core watch.
Yeah, yeah,
with a fairly large budget.
All right, so I've got 5. Let's see here. I've got 5, 4, 1, 2, 3. Yeah, I've got 5 picks. I think I meet the criteria, but I'm curious to see how you broke this down. What's your kind of fancier choice?
So the fancier choice, I went with the Longines Heritage Tuxedo Chronograph.
Mm, okay.
Great looking watch, the right size, enough presence that it doesn't feel old or dainty.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you're not even coming close to the upper edge of the budget. And I think it's just simply more interesting than a Datejust or something like that. And there's nothing wrong with the Datejust. Of course, I own one, but it's a little bit, this is more sporty, interesting than super normal, something conventional you see every time. The Heritage Tuxedo Chronograph, it's $3,900. And I think that's where dressy chronograph is kind of tough, but I think this treads the line of being enough vintage inspired, but still a pretty tractable size and good on a lot of different straps. So that's kind of my first choice.
Yeah. All right. Good pick.
What are you thinking?
Yeah, for this one, I went with, I feel like this one's kind of squarely in the criteria for a TGN dressier watch, the Anordain Model 2 Porcelain.
Good call. Yeah, yeah.
They've got a medium size and a large size, so you can take your pick. Looks like the medium is 36 millimeters. That's probably the one I'd pick. I think that's a great size. Such a handsome watch, but, you know, the Model 2 is kind of their take on a bit of a field watch. It's got 5 bar of waterproof, you know, pressure resistance and whatever, but you know, I think the key here is it's a bit dressier. I mean, it's got kind of a sports watch case, but it's the beautiful porcelain dial that Anordain does so well. So And that one comes in at a little over $2,500. So, well within the budget. Yeah. All right. Next category is, I don't know, where do you want to go? I mean, I guess I've got another fancy one too. I'll just dip in here with this one as well. And it's, I think it's kind of along the same lines, and it's the Fears Brunswick 38 Copper Salmon.
Okay. Yeah, for sure.
The Brunswick is kind of that cushion style case, you know, bit Radiomir Panerai style, kind of from the 30s. It's got a kind of a rounded onion crown and then this gorgeous mm-hmm. brushed salmon dial. I love what Fears does, and I think this kind of would fit. So there are kind of two choices for you for a fancy watch, and that one is $3,500, so $1,000 more than the Unordained, but still well within the budget.
I think that's another great pick. I think in the same vein of like it's fancy but conventional and you could kind of do anything with it.
Yeah.
Basically, I'm not a huge fan of the go anywhere, do anything moniker.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to be thrown around a lot. But you want a sporty watch that's also kind of dressy. My mind immediately goes to Grand Seiko.
Mm-hmm.
And the SBGW 297 is $5,900. It's a smaller watch. It's absolutely dressy. Especially if you matched it up on you know, a leather strap or that sort of thing, something with a bit of shine to it. But at the same time, we're talking about a steel watch, right? Like a fairly straightforward, well-made, you know, accurate, nicely designed sort of steel watch. So yeah, the SBGW, it's my favorite Grand Seiko.
Yeah.
And I like that it kind of combines, you know, I would say it's a step, maybe two steps dressier than any Rolex option short of a Datejust.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, it's more interesting. I love the dial design on it and that sort of thing.
Yeah. Yeah. I like that. I think you've talked about that one before. It's got that wild dial on it.
It's very beautiful. And I think it's a little more subtle than some of the ones with all the color and the texture.
Yeah.
And then in terms of the size range, you're looking at like 36.5 millimeters for the case. There's a darker dial in blue if you want. I of course prefer the lighter white dial, blued seconds hand, just a good looking thing. I would put it on a strap most of the time, I think, to try and give it different flavors in terms of maybe what I was wearing to the office and that sort of thing. But yeah.
Yeah.
And I like yours too. Like the Anordain and the Fears kind of work together.
Mm-hmm.
They're very different. And I think the Longines and the Grand Seiko could be worn in the same scenario, but are two entirely different options.
Yeah. 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 All right. Good calls. I think we're squarely in the wheelhouse here. How about moving up to, I guess it's a bit of a dress watch. Well, I mean, I don't know. You know, honestly, I feel like all my choices kind of run in the same area except for the Beater. But another one that I've got here that I guess fits a number of these categories is the recently released Zenith Defy Revival A3643. I saw this one, I think, that, you know, there was a story on Hodinkee about this, and it's a $7,800 watch, so we're ticking up a few thousands here from the previous choices. But yeah, it's a 37 millimeter octagonal case watch with the kind of funky bezel. It's, you know, it's just Zenith is doing some kind of cool stuff with the Defy family. You know, I think mm-hmm. well, whether it's the divers or the watch like this, and it comes in a few interesting dial colors. I just like the straight up silver. I think this just looks so kind of late 60s, early 70s. It's got this ladder bracelet, which I'm not super keen on. I think, you know, arm hair is a concern there, but it's a kind of a neat nod to the history. And yeah, I think this is also one that kind of fits the theme here.
For sure. Yeah. I think that's a fun one for my next pick. And again, like, I guess we're trying to thread one fancier option, one everyday dress sports, and then one Beater. And then I guess two wild cards.
Yeah, I guess so. I think you understood it more than me. I feel like mine are all kind of similar style, but anyway, that's where I'm going.
Sure. I mean, with a budget of say six to $12,000, with some being under so far, both of mine being under the $6,000 line, I do think it's worth, in this world where, you know, dressy is one thing, but you can also just get a very subtle sport watch where it just calls no attention to itself.
Mm-hmm.
And I think everybody's thinking the same thing at this point. It's a 36 millimeter Explorer.
Mm.
You could buy a 14-270. You could buy a modern one. They're all going to cost you in that $6,000 to $12,000 range, probably, depending on what you pick. If you're able to walk into a store and get one, you're looking at $7,900, I believe, right now. And I think it's essentially unbeatable.
Yeah.
It's a watch that there's nothing more than you need there. There's nothing less. You could buy that once and wear it for 50, 60 years at in an office scenario, and it's never really out of place. Mm-hmm. If you're dressing in a manner where an explorer is totally out of place, you could probably just not wear a watch.
Yeah.
And it would be acceptable.
Right.
So yeah, that would be the next pick. And I guess that leaves me with maybe one wild card and the beater.
I could slot this one into the wild card, and I'm glad, you know, one of the stipulations was we can't pick the same watch. And so you came pretty close, because my next pick is the 36 millimeter Tudor Ranger. I think, you know,
they're another great choice.
Everything you said about the Explorer, I think you could say about the Ranger. Mm-hmm. It's 3775 on the bracelet. With the black dial is where I'm headed with that one. Even though I love the new kind of desert themed one, I think the black dial is just gonna be more versatile for the scenario that Sam is outlining here. And yeah, so, you know, enough said. I don't think we need to get too crazy with explaining the Tudor Ranger. I think it's just it's a favorite of ours, and I think it would fit really well in this category.
Yeah, and I think there's also a world in which in this zone of things being under 6,000 but up to 12, that could count as your beater.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like if you wanted something, because it really isn't a very dressy watch, but it is that subtle.
Mm-hmm.
You could just wear it.
Yeah.
Just a you know, watch you could put on and enjoy. But yeah, I agree. Tudor Ranger and 36 millimeters, great call. For my wild card, I'm going to go with something that is quite dressy. And that's a watch I really like. Finally got to see them in person a little while ago. And the Denison ALD.
Mm.
So that's the two time zone Denison.
Yeah, good call.
So now if you're traveling for work, or if you're wanting to track another time zone for a colleague in a different time zone, pretty common thing to do, you have this cool watch. It's a real departure from the Longines, the Grand Seiko, the Explorer. You can get them in kind of less or more subtle versions of what, you know, stone is used for the dial and that sort of thing. But they're kind of exciting. They're kind of fun. Maybe this is your Friday afternoon. You know, you're going out for work drinks afterwards. It's a little bit more fun. It's a little bit more, there's a way to wear this more casually versus more dressy. But then if you also had to dress up for a work function or something more formal, a wedding, these watches still apply. And if you don't want the dual time version, they make one that's not, yeah, right? They do, yeah, both.
Yeah, that's a good call.
And that's like in the range of $900 to $1,400. So just well under the budget.
Yeah, it's such a specific look too, and it'll definitely turn some heads, and it's fun, and yeah, and it doesn't set you back too much. That's a good call.
Yeah, the Explorer says that you like a nice watch, but yeah, it doesn't necessarily say that you like watches.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's
you
a good
know what
way
I mean.
To put it. Yeah,
and whereas the Grand Seiko, the Longines, a little bit more nerdy, a little bit more specific, and then this is a whole jump where it's like, oh, you're in pretty deep.
Yeah.
This is a shaped case. This is 70 appreciation of like a late 70s aesthetic. You mm-hmm. could get one in, you know, Tiger Eye or Aventurine or, you know, Black Onyx and like all these other. And yeah, I think this is a space where you could have a little bit of fun and where you could be nerdy, but not in a way that's like, and I say this, of course, as the biggest nerd for Aqualands, not an Aqualand at the office. You know what
yeah,
I mean?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So, yeah. All right. What have you got for your fifth and final? What are we up? Is your beater the one that's left then?
Yeah, yeah. My beater is, you know, in the old days, you know, early days, 10 years ago in TGN, it would have been probably a, you know, an SRP, you know, Seiko Turtle or something like that. But I feel like there's a brand that, well, it's the brand that I'm wearing today, Elliott Brown. I feel like they've kind of slotted into that territory. And it's, I think they're straight up Holton, not necessarily the GMT that I'm wearing, but their first Holton Professional for $587. Quartz watch, you know, developed for the SBS. It's just tough as nails. It's got a great bezel, a great loom. I can't say enough good things about these watches. I just think that they kind of occupy that space of you can be a true watch nerd, but kind of someone asks you about it, you've got a good story to tell, or it doesn't matter. It's just a watch that works, and just have such a fondness for these. They're just such tough watches that I think it would make a great beater and still allow you to kind of enjoy wearing a watch rather than just kind of putting something kind of an afterthought on. I think it's a great
for pick. Sure. Yeah, good call. Good call there. My beater, I'm really stuck on two different options. The first one is something like a Halios Universa.
Mm, yeah,
that's going to put you about $1,000, but it still has a little bit of that dressy vibe. You're not buying a dive watch, for example. But to be clear, if you have the SBGW 297 and the Explorer 2, do you need the Universa?
Yeah, right.
In this world, and it's a bit of a weird decision, but it's, you know, it's what I might do in this scenario. My quote unquote beater, I think it's a Tudor Black Bay 58925.
Oh, wow. Oh, my goodness.
So still can do the office. But then if you want to treat it like a dive watch, it's a real dive watch. Put it on a taupe strap and it's very subtle and it looks great. And at the same time, throw it on a NATO and wear it on vacation.
Yeah.
Right.
That's great.
So that, I think that kind of splits the difference of like, it's still in the dressy realm. You could obviously just go Black Bay 54,
yeah,
where the sizing brings you down into something that feels less sporty and more in the realm of a dressier piece. But I wouldn't call the 54, especially dressy, or the standard, the 58 more so, mm-hmm, I think. Up for debate if you disagree, of course. A good combo for the Slack. But the 58925, like, just with it being silver, with it being that distinctive colorway, that kind of very subtle, not that aggressive sort of colorway of the kind of taupey,
yeah,
tone, I think does a nice job.
Yeah. All right. Good. Great. Fun challenge. Good question. I guess that probably could have been a full episode. You know, we've considered pulling some of these questions out for full episodes, and I don't know,
for sure, like
we sunk our teeth into that one. So that was fun. Thanks for that one, Sam.
All right. Next up, we've got a question from JR, who presents sort of a time machine question. He says, Jason, it's 1960. You just graduated from the University of Minnesota and you were commissioned as an ensign in the Navy. You have 2 weeks to get your duty assignment on Coronado Island. Your father offers to buy you a watch and your rich uncle offers to buy you a car. What is the watch? What is the car? What is your route to Coronado? And then for me, he says, James, it's still 1960. You are an RCAF captain and aviator going on a liaison assignment to the USN in Pensacola. You have 2 weeks to get to Pensacola. You need a new watch and a new car. Same question, what car, what watch, and what route? So an exceptionally complicated question there from JR. Jason, do you want to dig into your pick of watch, car, route?
Sure, yeah. It's a good year for watches and for cars and also for route, at least the direction I'm going. So the Tudor 7928 Submariner was introduced in 1959 and became a pick for the U.S. Navy, as I learned when I was writing that story about the splashdown frogmen story for Hodinkee a while back. And seeing as it's 1960, I mean, and I'm in the Navy, I think that's the pick. I think it's a 7928 Submariner Tudor. And then as far as a car goes, 1960, going to California, it's gotta be something fun. It's gotta be something sporty. And I'm going with a 1960, Alfa Romeo Giulietta. So, it's kind of the, you know, the precursor to the kind of classic, Spider that we saw in The Graduate, you know, kind of the long lived,
sure,
Alfa Spider. It's the Giulietta. So it's such a pretty, beautiful kind of late 50s, kind of mid-century design car. Mm-hmm. And that's my pick. And then for the drive, I'm taking Route 66. So it's,
there you go.
It's, you know, it goes through Oklahoma, New Mexico, Arizona, ends up in California, just, you know, north of Coronado, but I'll have to just jog down the coast a bit to get to my final destination. But, in those days, you know, this was, you know, the interstates were still being developed. And Route 66 was the route to take. And, a lot of history there. So that's my route. I got my sub on the wrist. I'm driving the Alpha. Hopefully it holds up for the long drive. And I'm taking Route 66 down there.
That's great. Yeah. Good answers all around. I mean, to be clear, for mine, I picked the same car.
What?
A 59.
That's great.
Giulietta Spreader Veloce.
Oh my gosh.
I've driven a 59 Spider with, not a specific, it wasn't factory Veloce, but it had like Veloce bits. I've driven it around LA, an absolute delight. And you get to feel a little bit like Freddie Miles from The Talented Mr. Ripley. I kind of thought you might go first gen Corvette, you know, assuming late 50s for the purchase of said vehicle. Can get really picky on what month a certain car came out in 1960 and that sort of thing. But yeah, I don't know. I've got my favorite vintage cars right now are Alphas.
Yeah.
While I prefer the generation after the Giulietta, when you get into, 1750 GTVs and that sort of thing, those are later on than 1959, 1960. So yeah, I figured I would go with the Alpha as well. So what color are you thinking for yours?
Oh, it's gotta be red. I mean,
yeah.
Yeah. How about you?
The one that I drove around LA briefly was dark gray over red leather. Mm. And I think that's the move for mm-hmm. me.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then look, for the watch, I figured I would let the story inform my decision. If I'm an RCAF captain, there's a chance that I would have the Rodania RCAF monopusher chronograph.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
I mean, a fairly rare watch. I might be, you know, putting myself into a certain scenario for the Rodania, but these are like exceptionally beautiful watches. I'll include a look at one from Analog Shift, but these were definitely very cool, and I think would make sense for this storyline. There's a chance that I'm a little off in terms of timing, but it's my understanding that these were around in this era, so maybe there's a chance that's what I would have on my wrist, and I just think that's exceptionally cool.
Yeah,
you know, it's a I believe this timeline would be a little bit early for like one of the Breitling mono pushers, and these ones kind of came before. But yeah, the Rodania Royal Canadian Navy mono pusher chronograph.
Fantastic.
I'll show an example of it, but a very cool watch.
Yeah.
And then as far as the drive, I mean, like Jason's got 66, I'm going north south, but I'm really not in a bad way. I think I would do sort of a 3 to 5 day sort of, I'd do Appalachia and then through Bourbon Country and then into the deep south mm-hmm. and then end in Pensacola. So that'd be, you know, like Toronto to Pittsburgh, maybe do New River Gorge, from there, down to Asheville and the Blue Ridge Mountains, then on to Chattanooga, which I've been to before and really thought was cool. And I have to imagine it was quite an interesting place in the early, very early 60s. And then from there, Chattanooga, we'd go down into Pensacola. And yeah, I think that would give me a nice sort of run and a few options of kind of different scenery. And I love everything I've ever seen of sort of Appalachia and in that area. So
yeah, good route. Yeah. Fun question. Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I can't believe we both chose alphas. not just alphas, but the same car. That's pretty wild.
The same one.
Yeah, yeah. Right.
Yeah. I didn't write down any alternatives.
Yeah.
I thought just based on sort of the astronaut connection, you might go early Corvette.
Yeah.
But I haven't driven earliest Corvette I ever drove was a C3, mid 70s Stingray. But yeah, cool cars for sure. But yeah, the alphas just have a certain spice to them I prefer. And I think for a car that is going to be derived from the 50s,
yeah,
versus a car that was made in like a car that sold in 1960 is a 50s car. I think that they made a very cool thing in that era.
Yeah. Yeah. Funny. My dad actually owned a first generation Corvette. I should have thought of that when I came up with this. If it had been dad getting me the car and uncle giving me the watch, maybe I would have picked a Corvette.
All right. Thanks so much for that question, JR. A really good, a goodie. And I would love to know, JR, your answer to a version of this question. So let us know in the Slack if you've got an answer for car, watch, and route for either of these scenarios, I suppose.
All right. Next up, we've got a question from Jason Surma, who says, who are your favorite F1 teams and drivers, and what are your predictions for the this was last year's question for the 2025 season, but let's move it forward to the 2026 season. James, I got to defer to you on this one. You can take this one wholeheartedly because I just don't follow F1. I watched Drive to Survive. I liked Nico Hülkenberg. Mm-hmm. I like George Russell from his Instagram feed, but yeah, I just don't follow the sport. So I'll let you go wild on this one.
I don't know. I don't care about teams. I don't really watch the sport, and like Sarah and I watch every race, but I don't watch the sport as a fan of a team or necessarily a driver. It's just kind of like, what's the best possible race? I just want to see a good race. And so right now, I mean, with what's happening in 2026, we have new regulations. We have cars that are largely about energy management, electronic energy management. And it's leading to some really exciting opening laps in these races, where there's a lot of kind of slicing and dicing and getting in there and, you know, wheel to wheel sort of action, which is scary in Formula One because it's very unforgiving. You're not really bumping into each other like you might be in other sports. It's just the cars kind of disintegrate when they touch each other. But yeah, I would say, you know, from favorite teams, since I got back into watching it really, you know, concertedly in, say, 2021, McLaren has been really fun to watch, and then watching them kind of turn a season around. The longer I watch the sport, the more I really appreciate Verstappen for his just the raw quality.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's largely been painted in some ways as like a bit of a villain or like not the guy you're supposed to like because he's too good, and like neither of those feel necessarily true, but just an incredible talent. He's very exciting to watch. And when you get Verstappen and a Russell and a Leclerc running up at the top, arguably wheel to wheel, that's just going to be exciting. So those are some of my favorite guys. I was really pumped to see Piastri's run last season, talking of 2025, but of course that didn't really last. And it was a huge year in the end for Lando, which was very exciting. Yeah, I'm into just watch whatever makes the sport best. I mean, you look at this past weekend as we're recording this, we have the youngest ever, second youngest ever winner of an F1 in Kimi Antonelli in a race. He's 19 years old.
Wow.
And he just did an absolutely stunning job in the Mercedes. Mm. And look, when you have a regulation change, it kind of resets the field to a certain extent. It's still a sport where the four or five main teams are always at the top. Or at least always in contention for the top. In this year right now, it looks like Mercedes has substantially better understanding of the regulations and the cars and that sort of thing. And to see them, you know, run 1-2, but to have Antonelli at the top and also to be the youngest pole sitter in history, it's an exciting era. It's a wild time for the sport, and I think tough time to be Cadillac, tough time to be Audi coming back in. They have the best looking car, to be fair. Great colorway.
Yeah.
But yeah, and anything that makes the sport exciting, I'm down for. I don't really have any allegiance. I'm not buying any of the polo shirts or the hats. But Sarah and I watch every race. We watch all the qualifyings. We really enjoy it. My kids are into it and all that. But yeah, it's more for me about just watching great racing.
That's a great way to watch any sport, to be honest. I think when you get really attached to a team or a player or a person or a competitor, you're setting yourself up for so much heartbreak and disappointment that it's kind of just nice to sit back and watch neutrally and just enjoy the action. So cool.
If you're wanting to understand more about the sport, Acquired just dropped a 4.5-hour episode on Formula One.
Jeez. Wow.
It's mostly about the absolute maverick knucklehead that is Bernie Eccleston. So far, I'm maybe 2 hours into it. But it's definitely exciting and worth listening if you want to understand more of the business side of the sport and how it comes together and why it's worth so much money and that sort of thing. Anyways, long answer.
All right. Let's jump ahead. We've got a question from Dan H., which is related to Formula One, that maybe we can pull up here just to kind of put a bookend on this Formula One stuff.
So yeah, Dan says, if you had your pick of all the current F1 teams, which one would you choose to drive for? And what would your company car be from that team? So Jason, as you can imagine, if you're a Ferrari driver, you pretty much have access to any of the Ferraris. And you're probably being paid so much that you could buy any of them. I don't really know, Charles Leclerc is seen in all of these, including up to, I'm not a huge modern Ferrari fan because there's no manual transmissions at all.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, a Monza SP2 is pretty great, right?
I love seeing these guys, these Formula One drivers show up in, Monaco or something in just this incredibly rare vintage, whatever
the vintage stuff's nuts.
Mercedes Ferrari or something. It's just crazy.
Yeah. I mean, Toto showing up in a 300 SL.
Yeah.
That's pretty great. I think Leclerc got married in a vintage Ferrari.
Oh, I saw that.
That sort of thing. So yeah, there's definitely some good ones. I'm going to have the craziest answer.
Hmm. Okay.
I don't think I would want to be in this sport and have the expectation of being a Ferrari driver or a Mercedes driver or a McLaren driver or a Red Bull driver.
Mm-hmm.
I'd rather be in a bottom ranked team earning $8 million a year or whatever after endorsements.
Yeah.
And just have a lighter understanding of it didn't work out for us this year. It's a building year.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
And so in that scenario, and because of the car I could pick as my company car, I'm going to pick Cadillac.
Oh, okay. Wow.
So today, if I won a lottery, my first call would be to a Cadillac dealership to buy a CT5V Blackwing. It's a four-door sedan that has a six-speed transmission and a huge V8. But yeah, I love the CT5 Blackwing. I like everything about it. It's a ridiculous idea that will eventually go away and has largely gone away from most other brands. And yeah, I would, if I could be a Cadillac driver, have a relatively lower, maybe I get a nice bonus if I get some points at some point during the year, but there's no expectation of me winning a championship. We're trying to build the team. We're trying to understand the regs. We're trying to launch something that's going to last a long time, but we're not expected to be on the podium. And I could have a Blackwing in the garage. Let's just do that. That sounds great.
All right. Well, based purely on the company car thing, I'm going to go with Alpine.
Yeah. Where would you
Alpine? Land? I want an A110. I think they're just such I mean, it's definitely a humble car compared to, you know, the ones that the Ferrari guys and the Mercedes and your Cadillac have. But I don't know. There's just something about that blue, the styling.
It's a great car.
It's a great car. I kind of love the history of Alpine. And you know, if there was ever an opportunity to, you know, to get into one of the vintage ones for some sort of events or just kind of keep in the garage, I think.
A road rally.
Yeah, exactly. Right. So.
Yeah, cool. Good pick. I think Alpine's awesome. And being a Formula One driver of a, you know, not always the most successful team, but I think there's potential on Alpine. They could probably figure out how to get one for you in the States on some special registration or that sort of thing.
Right.
But yeah, cool cars for sure.
Yeah.
All right. Next up, we've got a question from Austin R. about our creative process. He says, what is your creative process like? Over the last few years, you've instituted changes and new ideas like the subscriptions, the Slack, crew and A's, gift guides, one watch tournaments. How do you brainstorm new ideas and where do you draw inspiration from? Do you two get on a dedicated meeting once a month and discuss the podcast? Secondly, do you two think of yourselves as small business owners? And if so, did you ever expect to be? Jason, you want to tackle any side of that? It's such a quick answer for the first half.
Yeah, I had to chuckle with the dedicated meeting once a month to discuss the podcast.
Jason and I aren't really meeting types.
One less meeting. I mean, there's
no meetings.
I think it's like an hour before we go on to record. What should we talk about today?
Yeah, and if we come up with an idea, I've been open about this. I typically kind of steal ideas or I gain inspiration, if that's better, from other podcasts, from other genres. So when we started to run a lot of drafts or draft ideas, same when we started doing it with Hodinkee on Hodinkee Radio, that was because I was listening to a ton of All Fantasy Everything.
Mm-hmm.
And now I watch the way that like The Ringer with The Big Picture does drafts, and I think that's an even more clever way, where every pick kind of has to fall into a category rather than just a broad, you know, genre, if you will. And that could be a lot of fun. You know, we have a running chat for each other, where we trade ideas and where we come across possible, like, hey, do you want to have this person on? Do you want to have that person on? So we have a little list of guests. We have a running chat. We don't do meetings. There's nothing really official about what's going on. I mean, like, I do believe that a podcast kind of has to be timely, and that part of what makes our podcast feel like a conversation is that it's not that scripted or planned. You know, sometimes we'll pick a topic an hour before we record. Sometimes it's just, I told Jason I had to go a day early and he said, all right, we'll do Slack crew and A, and you go, perfect. And you just move on from there. And other times you have to do a one watch tournament, and it's going to require tech and planning and structure and assets and all that kind of stuff. So it's a mix. But I haven't ever seen such a high reward in terms of listenership or changes or growth or whatever that sort of thing might be, by heavily planning or, you know, putting rails in. It just seems like if we're talking about what we're interested in, that's kind of the point. So we really don't stress it much more than that, outside of a few options. We always have our end of the year shows. We have our megasode after Watches and Wonders and that sort of thing. But for the most part, it's pretty just kind of what we're into. What do we want to talk about?
Yeah, I think, you know, 10 years on, I think it could be tough to be original and fresh, but I think it's been a huge help to have the Slack community as well to inspire us and offer topic ideas. Yep. Things come up that we think, oh, you know, so-and-so talked about this on Slack and maybe we should turn that into an episode. And then also I think that the topics that we discuss, you know, the adventure, travel, diving, driving, et cetera, it's in a world that's always evolving. So there's always new things to talk about, especially in the watch world, even if it's in our kind of our older formats, or kind of the series we've run over the years. And then I think in the past few years, I think we've gotten a little more, I don't know if confidence is the right word, but, you know, we've just been trying to have more guests on regularly. And I think that really helps with variety. I think after 10 years of just kind of you and I talking to each other, it's kind of nice to have a third party or a different voice in the mix. And we've had some pretty stellar guests on even just so far this year, you know, with Cole and Lydia, and it's been great. And Guy.
Yeah, for sure. Guy Allen.
Yeah. And then in terms of small business owners, I don't know. I can't say I set out to be a small business owner, but I established my LLC in 2014 when I went freelance, and I haven't really looked back. Yeah. I can't say I planned to own a business, and it's not a business in the strictest sense, but looking at it now, you know, you and I, we have vendors and we have, you know, customers and payers and payees and, you know, bookkeeping and that sort of thing. So it's kind of evolved and we've just sort of learned how to do it as we've gone along.
Yeah, I would say like, I guess I always kind of thought I would work for myself, whether or not that's necessarily within the confines of a small business, I suppose so. But this definitely is a part of the broader business, which used to be a lot more freelance and that sort of thing, and now blends in with a full-time role with Hodinkee. But yeah, I think I've always kind of figured I'd work for myself. I've never been that great of an employee. I've never been that great at working with a large team of people. You know, Jason and I work really well because we don't overextend what we're capable of doing. And we kind of tie into that understanding. But as far as the grand creative process, it's kind of like, would we want this if we're going to try and add something to TGN? And when it comes to an episode, whether it's a guest or a topic or whatever, it's like, would we listen to this? And if it doesn't pass those kind of very low bars, then yeah, we probably wouldn't bother or we don't bother with it. But yeah. Thanks so much for that question, Austin. Next up, we've got one from Drew G, who says, what's a memorable reverse flex watch that you've seen someone wear at a high-end event? Something that made you think, ah, that's cool because it went against what might be expected. And then more to us, what is the favorite reverse flex watch in our collection? Jason, anything stand out where someone, you know, was wearing a watch that, I guess in my mind, that maybe the reverse flex is like you have nothing to prove. You pick something and you wore it.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I can't think of anything at like a high-end event or a specific memory, but I have found it kind of cool when I've been on a few brand-sponsored kind of dive trips over the years, or even just, you know, mountain getaways or ski trips or whatever, and you see like all the journalists and the brand people are wearing these high-end, you know, whatever it might be, Blancpain, Panerai, whatever. And then the professional guides, you know, the dive guides, the boat captains, et cetera, are out there wearing their Casios and Ironmans and things like this to... They're wearing them diving, or you know, maybe it's a Seiko at best, you know, to kind of in terms of watch nerd credibility. But yeah, I always kind of liked that. I kind of enjoy kind of sidling up to those guys and see what they think of all of this high end watch stuff, and kind of get their take on a different type of watch enthusiasm, or if it's not enthusiasm, at least it's you know, it's what their go to is. I guess in terms of my own collection, I think. You know, I could say the Aqualand. I think that's a good kind of reverse flex in most scenarios. But also, I've got this 1995 CWC Royal Navy diver that has the big word quartz right in the middle of the dial. I think that's a fun watch to wear. I think, you know, to wear that to, you know, like if I ever get invited to like an Omega event again or something like that, it's kind of fun to wear something that's adjacent and has an interesting backstory and a little more humble, but also has some good credibility behind it. So how about you? Anything stand out?
Nothing stands out as far as a time where somebody wore something that felt like a reversal. I mean, like, you know, there's times you spend time with people who, you know, have $1 million collections and they're wearing something, you know, more entry level.
Yeah.
But even that, like, I'm not sure that's a flex. Maybe that's just what they wore. Maybe their Jorn or whatever was in the shop or they didn't want to go to their safe deposit box or whatever. And then as far as the ones from my own collection, I think, you know, I always think of like the Timex, you know, 8 lap, the Ironman, Aqualand for sure. Just watches that really don't have anything to prove, and also kind of exist only partially in the enthusiast space.
Mm-hmm.
Like even if watch enthusiasm didn't really exist surrounding the Aqualand would still exist. And then like, you know, it's a tough look these days given, you know, things we've learned about his past in the last little while. But you know, Clinton wore a Timex. That's, I guess that's a reverse flex if you're the president.
Yeah, right.
But yeah, not necessarily the face you want for that watch these days.
Yeah.
That is what it is. But yeah, that's about how it works for me. Thanks so much for that question, Drew G. And next up, we've got one from James Vincent. He says, you're at your favorite bar, restaurant, or pub in the world, and you stay till closing to enjoy a well-earned evening off of watches, gear, and TGN Q&A episodes. At the end of a better-than-normal evening, unwinding, the owner pours you a shot of that special bottle for special occasions, and he or she says they're retiring. Did you want to take this place on? What is the place, and would you take it on? Jason, do you have a kind of a favorite spot that, you know, if it was offered to you to you know, start a new chapter of your life as a barkeep or a restaurateur, would you want to step into that world?
Well, it's a place I haven't visited yet, but it's on my list. And I think I know for a fact I would like it. And it's one I've read about and people have kind of recommended. And it's called the Old Forge, which has the nickname the most remote pub in the world. It's on the Noidart Peninsula in Scotland. And mm-hmm. it requires either a ferry ride or to get there overland, you have to do a 28-mile hike to get there. So, you know, 3-day hike. And you know, I just love the idea that, you know, to take the hard way to do a 3-day hike and sleep in a bothy along the way or camp or whatever. And then you get to the end and you get like this really satisfying pint of beer. I think it's just such a great idea. And so, yeah, I think that would be my pick. I think the only place that comes close to that sort of vibe that I've actually visited was also in Scotland. And it was a place called the Applecross Inn that required this amazing drive up and over this kind of mountain pass and down this extremely windy hairpin road that I did in a Defender, actually in Lewis Heath's Defender, a few years back, and kind of similarly remote, but accessible by a vehicle. But something like that, I think, would be my pick.
Okay. Yeah, that's a good one.
How about you?
For me, I don't think there is one that I would really want to take over. You know, there's a few spots that I like, but I feel like owning it and trying to run it myself would ruin that, my enjoyment of it. And, you know, some of my favorite bars that I've been to or, you know, places for a great drink, that sort of thing, would be pretty far flung. You know, there's a couple of pretty killer spots I've been to, very quiet, low key sort of third story bars in Tokyo, where you go like, this is, if I made a bar, this is kind of like, this is the zone, I think, where it would kind of land. And yeah, certainly been to a lot in the UK that I thought were quite fantastic. But then the business side of it and I think it's quite a difficult way to sort of succeed. I'm not sure that I would want to be more than a patron. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I get that.
But there's a romance to the idea of like, oh, I could take this over from Jim or whatever, and but then what are you going to do then?
Right.
I'm not going to make the podcast anymore. Yeah. I've definitely dreamed of the idea, and like, you know, Sarah and I have talked about the idea of like doing something more like a brewery or what's known in some places as a slashy or a bottle shop, where you could also record the show and do live events and stuff like that, but that's a out of the scope. That's a different, perhaps an answer for a different question. Thanks for that one, James Vincent. That's a fun one. Got to think of a couple of good glasses I've had around the world.
All right, next up we have a question from Carl. He says, if you could see any four bands, singers, or musicians, alive or dead, in concert, who would you choose? I feel like we've had this one before, something similar.
We definitely had one where you could go back in time to a specific moment, like to experience unknown live performance.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you want to go back and forth? I've got my four. I mean, this is one you could come up with 20, but
yeah,
I'm not sure it's more interesting than four.
Yeah. Yeah.
What's kind of the first one that jumped to mind for you?
Yeah. The first one was an easy one for me. It was, you know, I grew up in the 80s listening to Sting and the Police, and the Police had broken up in 84, and I just missed, you know, being able to see them in concert. So I'd love to have gone back or seen the Police. You know, I'm not sure that if they regrouped now, if that would be as interesting as kind of in their prime, but that's my first pick.
That's a good one. Yeah. Mine's Pink Floyd, probably 1979, 1980.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which would put it just after the Wall. That said, I have a family member who got to see them at a now kind of infamous concert in 1975 for Wish You Were Here in Hamilton, Ontario. One that, you know, at least anecdotally or the urban myth, the urban legend is that it changed all of like the noise rules and laws for Hamilton. Yeah. I mean, Pink Floyd anytime after 73. So you could get some Dark Side of the Moon in there, but Wish You Were Here is probably the album I listen most commonly to by them. I've liked it since I was 16 and I heard it the first time. And I still like it the same way now. And then I think it'd be remiss if I was, you know, spending one of my four wishes in Carl's hypothetical, if I didn't put myself in a position where I could have seen Comfortably Numb live. I think that'd be pretty good. So yeah, let's call it a little later on, post 77.
Yeah.
And that'd be my first one, would be Pink Floyd.
Or that I'm going to piggyback on that. Pink Floyd was on my list too, so that was my number two. And So I'll skip ahead to my number three, and that would be Led Zeppelin. I think to see them in concert would just be incredible, you know, kind of maybe early, mid-70s, you know, maybe 75, 76, somewhere in there, kind of just, you know, kind of when they were at their prime. I think they're just the most amazing collection of musicians possibly ever put together. Just such an incredible band. Robert Plant's voice is an instrument in itself, and Jimmy Page, et cetera.
Man, so. by 75, you've got 3, 4 Houses of the Holy and Physical Graffiti on the possible set list.
Yeah.
That's really good.
Yeah.
And that means that actually allows me to free up one, because I would have also said Zeppelin's got to be something else to see live.
Yeah.
I'm going to go with the answer I gave in a previous version of this sort of question, and that would be Queen in the early 80s.
Mm.
I think would have been something else. You know, they have a very famous Montreal tape. They have Wembley as well. Either of those would be fine. There's something about, you know, I don't sit and listen to Queen that often, and I probably don't know the majority of their songs, but there's something about their hits in a huge theater. You know, Save Me and Bohemian Rhapsody and We Are the Champions. Yeah. Like, it's just that live would be nuts, dude.
Yeah.
It'd be nuts.
Yeah.
And the talent. Like with Zeppelin, like with Pink Floyd, I just think the talent's off the charts, especially when it comes to Mercury's vocals.
Yeah, yeah. All right, well, I have one more.
Your fourth?
Yeah, my fourth is a band I could potentially still see. They're still making music, and it's one that I discovered relatively recently, and I kind of wished I'd learned about them earlier, kind of like 2014 era, and that is The War on Drugs. It's a band that I kind of was off music for several years, and then recently, like within the past 2 years, I started going into their back catalog, and they're just incredible. I mean, the music, I don't know. I listen to, you know, Under the Pressure, like on repeat when I'm running, or, you know, just like some of their stuff is just, it's just phenomenal. There's some great live videos on YouTube that I've watched, of them in concert. And they just look like an amazing live band. Of course, they have live albums, which is a good sign that they're popular and do well in the live format, which can't be said for all bands. So, The War on Drugs would be my fourth pick.
That's great. Great pick. Definitely, if we extended the list, they would be on mine for sure.
Yeah.
A good one. Mine, speaking of bands that might not be that great live, you know, give me the Vines in about 2007. Hopefully Craig's not in a bad mood. I just, you know, one of my all-time favorite bands. I think if you take, I don't know, a dash of the Beatles, a dash of Nirvana, and then something that's for me more interesting than both of them, and put it together, you get the Vines. That said, it's a band that's known for only one kind of personality within their music, like Ride With Me in the Apple track, like in the iPod ad, and they have this other side, this more like sonic kind of psychedelic feel that I've been going back to for 20 years, 25 years at this point. Yeah. And I just, you know, there's 3 or 4 albums by them that will always be around for me, that I just absolutely adore, have aged really nicely. I haven't aged out of them. Like I did a lot of music I was liking at the time. I just don't catch that often now. Or I only do it more for nostalgia. These ones have never really left. In terms of like Winning Days and Highly Evolved and that sort of thing. So yeah, it'd be the Vines in about 2007. And then finally, and this is one you definitely can't see, it'd be Stan Rogers. There's a performance with Stan in 1983 on YouTube. I'll put it in the show notes. I wish I was sitting in that bar watching him kind of deliver a handful of songs and some funny banter in between. But yeah, Stan Rogers in about 1983, very specific, but I'll include the video in there. It's great.
Nice. Yeah. Good pick. Yeah. Fun question. Thanks, Carl, for that.
Yeah, fun question, Carl. Good one.
All right, let's wrap up with a kind of an easy one from the Loogie guy, or the Loogie guy. We're not sure how to pronounce that. Who, specifically for me, what is the backstory to Ruby, and what does the dog owner life look like? Presumably, this question was from last year before the cat came along, when I was just a one pet owner.
It's evolved.
It's evolved. Jeez, crazy. That's the dog and cat owner life is looking very different these days. So I got Ruby in the fall of 2024. This was, you know, after the summer after my divorce, and I was kind of just alone and kind of at loose ends. And just, you know, I had grown up with dogs, but I had never owned one as an adult. And it was always a little bit intimidating. And I think even, you know, being single, I guess at the time it was something that I was a little concerned about, because I thought, you know, dogs require a lot of attention, and I traveled a fair bit at that time, and I wasn't quite sure how I was going to handle that. Plus, you know, twice daily walks and, you know, picking up poop and the different vet concerns that you have with dogs versus cats, which I've had many cats over the years. And so I just started looking in kind of the rescue, online rescue websites for dogs locally. And she was actually the first dog I saw. So I saw her picture on, I think it was called the Rescue Pack. It's kind of a local dog rescue service. And I don't know, she just had a really sweet face. I took a friend along and went and met her and was smitten. She just had such a friendly demeanor. And it's funny because I took her for a walk. I met her. It was the weekend before I came to Toronto for that first year that we did the Timepiece show together. And I don't remember if I told you about it at the time, but I committed to adopting her, but I said, I can't pick her up until I get back from this trip to Toronto. And it was, you know, the first weekend in October, or actually I think it was the Thursday before, the first weekend in October, and I went and picked her up, and the rest is history. So it's, the dog owner life, I slipped right into it. I'm a full on dog owner. I've got all the gear. I'm walking her twice a day with listening to podcasts. And it's just been, a blast. I can't imagine life without her. So it's great. And she's getting along well with Smitty the cat. So, that's a good way to kind of bookend this episode, because I gave the cat update at the beginning and finished with a bit of a dog update. So
yeah, for sure.
That's
looking
the story.
Looking forward to meeting Ruby and Smitty. Maybe even this summer. We'll have to see how the travel pans out, but it might be kind of fun.
Yeah, geez. And maybe we'll have a goldfish or something by that time.
Oh, for sure. I'll bring you a pet. I'll just show up with one.
Yeah, the rabbit.
Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly. You can borrow Cornelia for a while.
Yeah, right. Right.
That's great. Yeah, thanks so much for that question and for all the questions. So a big thank you to the Loogie Guy, Carl, James Vincent, Drew G, Dan H., Jason Surma, JR, and Sam Cordle for the questions this week. We do have a stack left over for one final, and then we'll open up the thread and start this all over again. But we are approaching, you know, the big cycle of new watches for April. So it should be lots of fun episodes in the next little while. Jason, with that in mind, you want to put a bow on it with some final notes?
Yeah, sure. I came across this video somehow, I don't remember how, but it was from the Atlantic magazine and their YouTube channel. And it's actually an 8-year-old video that I just was not aware of. And it's called The Most Elusive Man in North America. And it's about this guy, Dog Ibey, who was a kind of a legendary free skier back in the 1960s and 70s, living in Whistler, actually, who then kind of went off and in his older years became a bit of a recluse, a bit of a, I don't want to call him a hermit. These things always sound so pejorative, but kind of moved into a bus in the woods in British Columbia, lives completely off the grid. He doesn't have a phone. He doesn't have internet, a bit Prenicky-like, but even more minimalist. And he's also an ultra marathoner. So he spends his days building trails and running through the woods, and he's in his 70s, quite eccentric, and apparently is very difficult to track down and interview. And only one person has done that over the years. So these reporters from the Atlantic decide that they want to kind of go track him down and interview him. And it's really quite good. It's a short video. It's about 14 minutes long. And I guess, you know, if I have one criticism with this video, but with any of this style video, is they're never long enough. You know, I always feel like they're just getting into the story and then they're over. And I'm like, this thing could have gone on for 45 more minutes. And I realized the constraints of budget and time and all that kind of stuff, but it's a very intriguing story. I love stories like this about people that kind of hung it up and turned their backs on kind of conventional society. I think it's a neat thing.
That's great. Yeah, good pick for sure. I've not seen this, so a good one for the lounge this evening before I jump on my flight.
Yeah. All right, how about you got a YouTube as well?
Yeah, I have a YouTube link. We've talked about Harry's Garage before, Harry Metcalf, you know, the guy behind Evo magazine back in the day. He now has this fantastic YouTube channel where he just talks about his cars or cars that he's borrowed, drives them around, you know, his farm or the roads around the farm. More recently, and more to the point of today's final notes, he got a few days to drive around the Gordon Murray Automotive T50. So I've shared some videos with the T50. This is the spiritual successor, we'll say, to the McLaren F1, made by the same guy, Gordon Murray. now under his own company. You're talking about a three-seater with a central driving position, six-speed manual, a Cosworth 3.9 liter V12 that revs to 12,100 RPM. I mean, this car weighs something like 2,300 pounds. It's quite pretty, and you know, I the divisiveness of the fan in the back is up to you. I think it's not something I need aesthetically. The car could be prettier, but just from the specialness standpoint of, again, the same layout as a McLaren F1, and then this insane motor and the six speed, and you know, all the switch gears custom, all the everything about it is custom. You know, these are a few million dollars, and then they're double that now. But this video is great because it's Harry in his very normal down to earth. He has a wonderful car collection, but I think if you've watched any of his videos, he comes at it like a museum curator. He wants to know all the details. He wants the book about the car. He loves to be able to drive them and explain the process. He takes them on long road trips. You know, he took his Testarossa down to Africa. he does some really cool stuff. I've met Harry once or twice at car events, and he's just an absolute gem. And I loved this video because it's a car where, you know, the Ollie Marriage Top Gear video was amazing, but it's a road test where they're, you know, going through tunnels and that sort of thing. And this is more like one old guy sitting in this totally raucous vehicle, just kind of giving you some context for it. And, you know, he has experience with enough other cars of this ilk to bring some context to the table. And then I'm not going to spoil it, but he goes and finds a friend, a very famous friend who lives in the similar area to him. And they go for a ride in the car, and it's great. It's a great piece of YouTube car video. And as a guy whose first or second car magazine was, you know, the McLaren F1 cover on Road and Track, which I still have. These cars will always fascinate me. And I think the T33 looks incredible whenever that kind of becomes more common to YouTube videos and that sort of thing. But special thing to see in a video, and Harry does a great job with it.
Yeah, I do like his stuff. It's good. All right.
Cool.
Fun episode as always. Thanks so
cars,
much.
Cars, cats, questions.
Questions. Yeah, right. Jeez,
guys bands. Who live in buses.
Yeah.
I love it.
All right. Well, as always, thanks so much for listening. If you want to subscribe to the show notes, get into the comments for each episode, or consider supporting the show directly, and maybe even grab a new TGN signed NATO, please visit thegreynato.com. Music throughout A Siesta by Jazzar via the Free Music Archive.
And we leave you with this quote from Samuel Johnson in The Rambler: curiosity is one of the permanent and certain characteristics of a vigorous intellect.